But now we're to meet a woman whose life has tracked the development of something that many in Australia mightn't even really believe exists. That's civil society in Singapore. She's now almost 78, and this extraordinary woman has spent 25 years as an overt feminist and humanitarian activist. And according to her recent memoir, Where I Was, a memoir from the margins, there are now real signs of change afoot in her homeland, Singapore. But above all, her story is proof that people can successfully amalgamate various different roles and identities in their lives and thrive. They become truly cosmopolitan, in other words. Not an altogether benign feeling, though, as we'll discover. Constance, good morning and welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you so very much, Geraldine. Lovely talking to you.
Constance, you actually say in your prologue to your book that this is a memoir from the margins.
Yes.
Tell us how and where you grew up and how you've wrestled with your identity as a Singaporean.
Well, I spent part of my childhood in India because of the war. During the Japanese occupation, my mother and my siblings were in India. But after that, most of the time, I mean, I grew up, I'm a Singaporean, born here and grew up and went to school here. And the last 50 years of when Singapore became independent, I have been part of that that project of becoming Singaporean, struggling along with all the other Singaporeans. What
yes.
is it to be Singaporean?
You had big dreams, I must say. Singapore, of course, became an independent republic in 1965 under
yes.
its first Prime Minister, Lee Kuan Yew, whom Australians are very well aware of.
Yes.
Just so that listeners get a sense of why it's been such a powerful force in your life, could you describe your Singapore for us?
Well, I think what was exciting about Singapore is that it was multicultural. And we started a country as a multicultural country, multiracial, multicultural. And one of the early dreams, as it were, of the founding fathers was that this was going to be a really strong, multicultural, meritocratic society. But along the way, some of that fell by the roadside when leaders changed their policies. And that's why I write about the struggle for identity, what is to be Singaporean. And in the 50 years of independence, I think Singapore has achieved industrialization, fastest industrialization any part of the world in the first 20 years
yes.
of Singapore.
And
that has been quite upsetting too.
Well, yes, you say that in fact the public identity of a Singaporean is increasingly a puzzle and
yes.
anxiety, even sometimes a source of distress, even to the majority race. What do you mean?
Well, for instance, the majority race is Chinese. And at some time in the 1970s, Mr. Lee Kuan Yew decided that he wants a homogeneous Chinese-speaking population. So what he did was to introduce Mandarin as the mother tongue for all Chinese. Now, which also means a loss of cultural identity even for the Chinese, because they were Cantonese, they were Hokkiens, and so on, different dialects, different cultural heritage, you know. So even they lost. So it isn't just the minority races like the Malays and the Indians. Even the Chinese races had to then, and I think they're still struggling. Who are we? What are we? What's happened? Each generation couldn't speak to the older generation because they didn't have the language.
So did those smaller languages like Shanghainese and Hokkien, are they still around? Do you still?
No, they're not, because everything in the language, Hokkien movies, Hokkien films, Cantonese, were all taken out of public viewing.
See, you also say this multiculturalism that you are so proud of, in practice, keeps us trapped in distinctive psychological and cultural ghettos.
Yes.
50 years after independence from Britain, we remain colonised in different ways. That's pretty strong stuff, Constance.
Well, it is, actually. That's our distress, you can say, because I think it's only now we are fighting against that, because we are so used to it's an authoritarian, autocratic government. We are so used to being put in these slots, you know, far more extremely than Raffles did. Raffles did divide and rule and allocated different areas for different races, you know. But this one, now we have the language that divides us. We have housing that divides us. Even on our identity cards, the race is very prominently displayed, and we have been protesting against that for the longest time.
Do you know each other or not?
We do. In spite of that, because the school system, we do have mix of students, but again, they get separated when they go to speak the different languages, when they go for different language study group.
Nevertheless, you're very proud of where Singapore's come, aren't you? Do you think it would have come that far without that benign, quotes, autocracy?
I don't know how benign they were, but never mind. We have come a long way. But we're also saying that how do you rate success and do we have to be so rich? But not everybody is benefiting from that wealth. And so we have arrived at a stage when that gap is widening. And I think that's one of the reasons why people are protesting. People are angry. I mean, we subscribe to your policy. We supported you. But is this what's happening? The next generation of kids, are they going to have housing? Can they afford to live in Singapore? They can't, you know. Mm. Lots of young people can't get housing, can't get married. And I think one of the problems with low fertility rate is that.
Well, of course, this is a very big debate in Australia as well.
Yes.
You're listening to Saturday Extra. Let me just tell my listeners here on Radio National, my guest is a Singaporean activist and author, Constance Singham, also described as the mother of Singapore's civil society, which is a great phrase, isn't it?
Responsibility.
Yes, well, obviously.
I was so surprised to be referred to. But you see, we came into, my organization came into being in the 1985, I think, at a time when civil society had been suppressed. In fact, a lot of civil society activists over those first 10, 20 years had been imprisoned, trade unionists, political activists and so on. So we had tough times those years, but Singaporeans supported that because we believed that since we have been expelled from Malaysia, we didn't have any natural resources and we have to have a docile population, docile labor force to encourage foreign investment. So we did subscribe to that. But also that meant the government became more autocratic and not listening to people.
Can I just see your own trigger for your social activism path? I understand, well, from your book, started when your husband of 18 years,
yes,
the journalist N.T.R. Singham, died in a private hospital in 1978,
yes,
due to the neglect of a cardiologist. And you wrote a letter, didn't you, to the Straits Times,
yes,
which triggered a debate about the standard of patient care in private hospitals, and that led to government action. Now, how did that change your life?
That it's possible to make a difference, that it is possible that we shouldn't be quiet. We shouldn't be quiet when something affects us. Too many people are too scared to do. In fact, that fear of the use of the Internal Security Act is still present in with people of my generation and the generation after me. And there's always the fear, when do we cross the line that's going to upset government? And of course, they have stopped using the Internal Security Act. Now they have other means of silencing people.
Well, in fact, when you were studying, because you've, you know, continued your study into higher education, some of it in Australia, when you were studying at Curtin University during the 1997 general election, I think you found that Singaporean students over here were under surveillance.
Yes, I had no idea, because when this student invited me to speak at University of Western Australia, and after that he told me that he was called up for inviting me. But also, I mean, when you talk about government control, it's at every level, and sometimes the minions at the bottom of the ladder probably overacts, you know, overreacts.
Overreact.
And they think this is how our bosses will want us to behave. So they tend to be more controlling than perhaps at a higher level.
In other words, you're saying that people live, even, are you saying even the elites, they live in a constant watchfulness about whether they've overstepped some mark?
Yes, that's right.
I gather that your prominence eventually gave you the ear of some people at very high levels of government. You tell the story of encountering the Prime Minister Goh Chok Tong, who promptly asked you, I think this is a couple of years back, what women want. What did you say?
I said what women want is quite straightforward. They just want to be treated as equals in Singapore, equal to the men in Singapore. You see, Singapore government and Singaporeans would like to compare us. Look, you women are doing much better than women in India and women in China and women in Malaysia. And I keep telling them, we don't want to be compared to other women in other countries. We want to be compared to women in Singapore. What happens is, you see, because of the very fast industrialization program, they needed a lot of women in the workforce. And they encouraged women in the workforce. At the same time, they were very patriarchal in their attitudes. And I think it's probably true of most countries, even in Australia. But that's the problem, you know. In Singapore, because we're a small island and with 5.4 million people and with one government in control, which controls practically everything in our lives, it's very intense, that kind of invasion into our private lives.
But do you still feel that? Because you do write that the subservience to government in Singapore has begun to disintegrate.
Yes, and mostly because we have the social media. Because now people can find a voice and have a media to express themselves. You see, before even the media was under the, everything was under the control of the government. So we did not have alternative sources. One, the social media, availability of social media. Two, a younger generation of voters who have gone overseas and studied and are coming back and who are not tolerant.
Look, you know, just a couple of more questions. I notice you've had some most unusual forms of protest over the years in Singapore, including the cook a pot of curry day.
Yes, yes.
And you're quite a keen cook yourself. Tell us what happened. What was that all about?
That was, you see, another why Singaporeans, another source of anxiety is the sudden influx of foreigners. And a lot of the foreigners come from China. And, of course, the Chinese are not used to curries. And here, as we are quite integrated in the public housing, and anyway, even the Chinese in Singapore eat curry. We've been together for, what, 100, 200 years. So, you know, the Malays cook curry, the Indians cook curry, the Chinese cook curry, Babas cook curry. And so when this new migrant protested against the smell of curry from their neighbors cooking, and the mediation council persuaded the Indians to, apparently the Indians agreed that they will not cook curry when their neighbors are at home. And of course, Singaporeans were so upset about that. How dare these foreigners come and tell us what we can eat and what we cannot eat? So somebody, I mean, very creative, I must say very creative, because it's one thing that won't get them into trouble, is to call for an apparently 40,000 people that weekend cooked curry. And shared curry.
What an amazing
I thought that was
a fabulous story. And what did they overturn that? What happened as a result of that?
We have no idea, because we haven't heard anything about it since.
So it's gone away, has it?
Yes, that's right.
Gee, you know, that's a pretty strong identity there you're describing, to be regarding the mainlanders as foreigners and to be so comfortable. And look, I notice in reporting the extraordinary story of Singapore considering building a genuine underground city, an extensive interconnected city with shopping malls, transportation hubs, public spaces, pedestrian links, cycling lanes, to gain more space. Now,
I know.
What do you think about
that? Another reason for our marginalization. I am lost in this city and I have no idea. But the problem is also because for some reason the government has got into its head that we must have a 7 million population. And for that, to provide housing and recreation and infrastructure, you have to find space. Now, you can't go on reclaiming land because your neighbors are going to protest. So now they have to go underground. And how that's going to work out is anybody's guess.
Yes, I noticed one of the, there was an old, a 69-year-old man, a retired accountant, said that a lot of us have relocated from kampongs to high-rise living, and now they're asking us to go underground.
Precisely. I mean, you know, you can see why we are struggling with our identity, you know. We have never stood still. We haven't. We keep moving and moving. And Singapore is such a small island, you can't escape. Like Australia, if you're living in Sydney and it upsets you, you can always move to the country, you know. But we have no space. So we are here in this pressure cooker of a city with no voice.
Constance, it sounds to me as if it hasn't done you a lot of harm, but
thank you.
It sounds pretty feisty and thriving to me. Constance, thank you very much indeed. It's great
to
hear characters coming from the Asian region and able to welcome them to this show. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, Geraldine.
And Constance Singham's book is Where I Was, a memoir from the margins. It's a select publishing publication from Singapore, so you might have to go to a bit of trouble to get it. And Constance Singham, a very welcome guest here to Saturday Extra.